When you hear the name Jesus, I wonder what thought instantly comes into your mind. When you think of heaven, again, let me ask you, what ideas do you think of? And then put them both together, and I wonder what picture is formed in your mind. I think it'd be fair to say that for many people in London, Jesus is a mere irrelevance, and at best, a religious figure that once influenced our culture. Heaven, well, that's kind of pie in the sky when you die, a make-believe world for weak people who merely dream of something like that. Now, if your opinion gets anything close to that, then I would love you this evening just to, for about 20 minutes, just to park your views and come with me to Luke's account of the life of Jesus. We for sure know that Luke is a highly accurate historian, and everything he writes down is from first-hand eye and ear witnesses. As we look at Jesus together, just maybe, as we look at him tonight, just maybe, your views may change as you see both the relevance of Jesus and just how exciting his view of heaven is. So, I want to get you involved tonight. I'm a youth worker, so you won't be surprised I want to get you involved. I want you to speak to the person who maybe either brought you or maybe the person you're sitting next to speak to them just for a few minutes with this question. What do you think heaven is like? What do you think heaven is going to be like? Okay. Let me give you a great compliment. You speak as loud and as long, at least, as the young people here at All Souls. I wonder what your answers were. If we were to go by the media's version, then it would be fluffy angels, harps, and everything white. Often I think many young people, when they think of heaven, they think of it as an eternal church service where the sermon goes on forever. There may be a few kind of hymn adverts in between, but it's basically a very, very long church service. If that's heaven, then do you want to go there? I certainly don't. If heaven's like that, if it's fluffy and white, or if it's an eternal church service, maybe Mark Twain was right when he said, go to heaven for the climate and hell for the company. Now, is Mark Twain right, or does Jesus have a different story to tell? In Luke, Jesus is constantly, if you read through the Gospels, Jesus is constantly telling stories which he uses often to reveal two things. He reveals his parables, his stories, to reveal truths about you and me, truths about human nature, and truths about God. In Luke chapter 14, we find Jesus at the home of a Pharisee, which in Jesus' time equals a really religious bloke. And funnily enough, Jesus and religious people just don't mix. In fact, it's the religious people in the end who get so fed up with Jesus that they end up murdering him and hanging him upon a cross. Now that is pretty fed up, isn't it? They're so fed up that they whack Jesus on a cross. And one of the reasons they hate him is because of his view of heaven. They hate Jesus because of his view of heaven, especially who he says will or won't be there. Just look with me at Luke chapter 14, verse 11. Just turn back. Look at chapter 14, verse 11. And then you'll see what I mean. He's in the home of a Pharisee. He's surrounded by religious people. And then he says this. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. What's Jesus saying? If you are humble, then you will be in heaven. If you're proud, then you won't be in heaven. Now please notice with me, both sets of people that he talks about need to be humbled, but one is and one isn't. And as the religious people listen to Jesus, they know for sure that what he's saying is, you guys are proud with a capital P, and if you stay like that, you will not be in heaven, for sure. Unless they obey him, unless they obey him by what he means by humble, you guys are definitely not going to be there. Just look at chapter 13, verse 26, and you'll see what I mean. This is Jesus speaking. He says, then you will say, regarding the religious people, we ate and drank with you, and you taught in our streets. But he will reply, I don't know you or where you have come from. Away from me, you evildoers. Proud people don't get into heaven. And Jesus is the judge who decides what is humble or what is proud. And the religious people, as they listen to Jesus, just don't like it. Well, that's what Jesus thinks about the residence. But what about the venue? What does Jesus think about that? What does he think heaven's actually going to be like? You know, one of the closest, I thought about that. You know, one of the closest images came into my mind when Jesus teaches about heaven is this, is the London Olympics. Now, whether you love the London Olympics or not, I absolutely love being in London. There was such a buzz. There was such an excitement. Now, when you think about the London Olympics, it seemed to me to resemble many things, but there were three things. Three things which kind of gave you a little taste of heaven. What were they? Number one, there was people from all the world's nations gathering together, what to do? To celebrate. People from all over the world together to celebrate. Now, when Jesus talks about heaven, it's always those three things. There's people from all the world's nations gathering together. Why? To celebrate. But you might ask, to celebrate what? Well, the answer is found, again, in the stories Jesus told. If you go to Luke 15, you see three of probably Jesus' most famous stories. They're all about things that are lost and found. The first story is of a lost sheep. And it's of a shepherd who looks for the sheep until he finds it. And then, when he finds it, what does he do? He throws a party. By himself? No. He gets all of his friends together, and then he gathers his friends together, and then he celebrates. And then Jesus tells another identical story. This time it's not a shepherd, but it's a lady. It's not a sheep, but it's a coin. And she loses a coin. She has 10, she loses one. So she looks for it until she finds it. And then she finds it. And then what does she do? She gathers everybody together. Why? To celebrate. And then, the last story in chapter 15 is of the prodigal son. And what do you get at the end of the story of the prodigal son? You get a mass party where everyone is celebrating. Like the other two stories, they're celebrating what is lost. But if you look a little bit closer, what you see is they're not primarily celebrating only what is lost, but actually something far more deeper than that. The thing that the people are toasting their glasses to, the thing that really makes their feet dance, is what moves their feet into dancing, is actually what makes the son's return possible. What is it that makes the son's return possible? It's the father's extravagant forgiveness. That's what makes it possible. He comes home. The father could tell him where to go. You left me, you took my money. Go back to that pigsty. But what does he do? He opens his arms. He gets the fat calf and kills it. He spends extravagantly. Why? Because his heart is full of forgiveness. Because he loves his son. You were lost but he's found. You were dead but alive. Come home. Let's celebrate. What a picture Jesus is painting of heaven. The nations of the world gathering together to celebrate God's love and forgiveness. What a feast. What a party. What a celebration. That's the picture that Jesus paints of heaven. Everybody, everyone is invited. No one's excluded. The way in is not by being good, but instead by being humble by your rebellion against God and accepting what? The Father's free forgiveness. And if you look at Luke 15, at the beginning of the story, there's a crowd. There's the religious people, and then there's the prostitutes, the tax collectors, the sinners. There's those who have been broken by their sin. There's those who are exalted, and there's those who have been humbled. And as Jesus tells that story, the religious people hate him for it. They hate him for his view of heaven. Why? Because they want heaven, a heaven that they can earn. They want to feel as if when they get to heaven, they deserve it. The thought of being called sinners, or being called a rebel, well, it just doesn't fit with their culture. And the thought of real rebels, real sinners, the real losers coming into heaven, coming into the party and celebrating. Oh, they just don't. That just doesn't get them. You get to heaven, you've got to earn it. You get to heaven, you've got to feel as if you deserve it. Filthy sinners partying just didn't do it for them. So we've seen that the religious people are fed up with Jesus, but they can't accept that undeserving rebels get into the party. So let's re-enter the home of the Pharisee. And what we see is Jesus sitting down with a bunch of them. It's a dinner party. And Jesus is the guest. And all around him are the Pharisees, the religious people. He's already said a few things which I'm sure would have made them choke on their dinner. But Jesus doesn't stop there. He really wants to get the message home. And then, just to kind of break the awkward silence, one of the Pharisees said something to him, which kind of agrees that heaven is going to be a party. Just look at chapter 14, verse 15. When one of those at the table with him heard this, he said to Jesus, "Blessed is the one who will eat at the feast in the kingdom of God." No doubt, like most of his mates, the religious guy thinks that if you actually look at the story beforehand in chapter 14, you'll see that the religious guy thinks that at the heavenly banquet, him and his mates are going to be in a top table. Jesus watches them as they come in, and he watches them as they take their places at the dinner table, and all of them take the place of most honour. And that's a picture of what they actually think heaven's going to be like. In heaven, they're going to be in the top table. And Jesus watches them. It's amazing in chapter 14, at the beginning, it says all eyes were watching Jesus. All the religious people. They planted a person who is lame, and it's the Sabbath, and they're thinking, will Jesus touch him? Will Jesus heal him? Jesus heals him. He's a plant there. And all eyes are watching Jesus. But then after that, it's Jesus watches them. They come in. They take their places at the feast. They all take the best places. And Jesus basically says, hey, guys, you think heaven's going to be like that, don't you? You've got the earthly season ticket, so the heavenly final is a kind of given. So let's see what Jesus says. Should not surprise us that Jesus uses his question, and then he tells another story. And the story this time is about a guy giving a party. But let's just say it's no small affair. Look at chapter 14, verse 16. Jesus replied, a certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. The banquet is great and the guests are many. But not only that, he hungers for every invitation to be answered and every seat occupied. Look at chapter 14, verse 23, and then you'll see what I mean. Then the master told his servant, go out to the roads and country lanes and compel them to come in so that my house will be, what? My house will be full. What does he want? He wants the party full with everyone enjoying, what? The fruits of his wealth. Everybody enjoying his deep generosity. That's what he hungers for. That's what he desires. Everything about the invite reveals lavish generosity of the man who's given the banquet. No empty seats. All the invites, emails and texts collected and saying what? Yes. As a young person, they can't even say okay these days in their text. It's just kay. I mean, how kind of short can you get? Kay. Well, he sent out the text and he's hoping that there's lots of kays. The desire is for all the people to enjoy his goodness with no one missing out. Whoever they are, whatever packaging they come in, he wants them there. Look at verse 21 again. Go out quickly into the streets and alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind and the lame. Again, Jesus doesn't matter. He doesn't care what packaging they come in. They could be a prostitute, a tax collector. They're the wasters of society. He doesn't care. God's lavish grace is open to them. So let's look at a few of the responses to the invitation. Look at chapter 14, verse 17. At the time of the banquet, he sent his servants to tell those who had been invited, come, for everything is now ready. But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said, I've just bought a field, and I must go and see it. Please, excuse me. Another said, I've just bought 5 yoke of oxen, and on my way to try them out. Please excuse me. Then another said, I've just got married, so I can't come. The party is ready, the invite's received, and if you like, The taxi is waiting. The servant has arrived. And as the taxi driver waits outside, the wait seems to go on forever and ever and ever. So what does the taxi driver do who's been sent by the master? Well, what does he do when he's waiting outside? What does any sort of taxi driver do when he's waiting outside? He just beeps the horn gently. No response. He beeps the horn again, just gently, just nicely. Looks out the window. There's no kind of neck curtain twitching. So he thinks, oh, I better get out and knock on the door. So he knocks on the door. And the door eventually opens and as an unshaven man arrives, clearly totally unprepared, and he's looking as if he's forgotten all about it. The servant says, the party, sir? Oh, the party. Oh, mate. I'm ever so sorry. I completely forgot about it. See, I've been working in the field all day. You see, I've just bought a field. It really is a lot of hard work. Please apologise. I'm sure you'll understand. The servant walks off not quite believing what he has just heard. How could anyone be so unprepared, so ready to exchange a field for such lavish generosity? As he gets in the car to drive off to the second person, the thought that dominates his mind, the little phrase that kind of keeps on whirling around in his head is this, but I'm sure he won't mind. Really? Really? When he arrives at the second house, the second person, it's the same scenario. The car waits. There's a beep on the horn. And eventually there's a knock on the door. This time the guy arrives, and this time he's caked in mud. The servant has the invite in his hand, and the man looks at it as if it's the very first time he's ever seen it. The servant says, the banquet, today. You received the invite through the post, email, text? Yeah, I remember now. Like the first man, he's totally unprepared and the sumptuous banquet is totally off his radar. The first man, just like the first man, he's very polite and pleasant. You read this parable and you think Jesus is speaking about British people, don't you? They're very polite and very pleasant. But at the end of the day, the oxen need what? They need feeding. The immediate totally dominates the eternal. The servant, now even more discouraged and a little worried about the trip back to the master, goes to the last house and, yes, you guessed it, the car waits. There's a beep on the horn. There's a knock at the door. This time, the door is opened not by one person, but by a lovely young couple. Both look absolutely full of the joys of spring, but like the first two, these young guys are completely unprepared. The excuse this time is that the guy received the invite a week before he got married, and he was not sure if the invite included his wife. The servant reminds the couple of his friend's deep generosity and that the party is open to all and the new wife is completely welcome. But the answer from the couple is exactly the same as the first. It's polite and it's pleasant, but it's no. Polite, pleasant, but no. The servant is now very discouraged and extremely worried about the trip back to his master. But back in the car he gets, completely empty, and by himself he returns to his master. As he drives home, it becomes obvious that in all the three guests, there were three things that were identical. What were they? Number one, they were all unprepared. Utterly unprepared. Number two, in the light of who was inviting them, and the greatness of the event, their excuses were absolutely feeble. And then thirdly, their politeness and pleasantness was merely a smokescreen to the fact that they did not really care at all about the invite and the banquet. As he drove up the big drive, what would you expect? Well, of course, the master is waiting. Obviously shocked as he looks Perhaps, you know, he's got a lot of money, this man. He's a sumptuous banquet. Everything about him is generous. Everything about him. Maybe it was one of those really nice big black limos with the darkened windows. So as it's coming up the drive, he's not quite sure. But as he gets nearer, he sees through the black windows and he sees it's empty. So let's look at what he says. Look at verse 21. The servant came back and reported this to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry and ordered his servant, go out quickly into the streets and alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind and the lame. I tell you, not one of those who are invited will get a taste of my banquet. Now you've probably worked it out already who the different people in the story represent. God is the generous guy who throws the lavish banquet. Christians are the servants who invite. Banquet is a picture of entrance into the kingdom of heaven. The banquet is the picture of a relationship with God, the God who loves you. And those who refuse to come are the proud people who turn down the Father's forgiveness. Now I wonder, as we went through that brilliant story that Jesus told, I wonder if in some way that describes you. It would be really unusual, wouldn't it, for Jesus, God, to tell a story and it doesn't apply to you. That'd be really, really strange if that wasn't the case, wouldn't it? It'd be really strange if Jesus, God, comes to earth, tells brilliant stories and it doesn't apply to me. It'd be really odd that, wouldn't it? It'd be really odd if it doesn't involve you. It doesn't apply to you. Let me put it to you. That story applies to every single person here tonight. Applies to me, and it applies to you. And Jesus, if he was here to say, if you've got ears, listen. I love you, listen to this story. As we went through the story, I wonder if it rang a few bells with you. Maybe when the invite's given to you to come into God's kingdom, to enjoy his bounteous forgiveness. Maybe your answer goes something like this. Maybe it's the science argument. Well, it's all that stuff in Genesis about God making the world. I mean, Christians just seem to have their heads in the sand. And anyway, if I owned up to believing in the Bible, my mates would absolutely destroy me. So you act as if the questions about science have no reasonable or rational explanations. You act as if these questions have never been asked before and can't possibly have answers. Just like the people in the story, you're very polite and you're very pleasant, but it's a no. Why? Because something is bigger than the feast. Why? Because someone is more important than Jesus. Or maybe you're like this. Maybe it's that you just feel so pressured with getting the right grades for uni. There's a knock at the door and it's not muddy shoes that you have, but a textbook in your hand. Like the farmer and the guy with the oxen, you're pleased to be asked, but following Jesus, being a Christian, well, it's just not on the radar. There's far more important things than that. Life's about books. Life's about study. Life's about uni. Life's about career. Life's about money. Life's about fulfilling your parents' expectations. You just about fit Sunday in. But to put Jesus first in every area of your life, well, it's just too big a cost. It may lead to your grades not being near perfect. It may lead to what uni you go to, or what job you get, or what standard of living you have. You're polite, but it's a no. Why? Because something's bigger than the feast. Something is more important than Jesus. That's interesting. All these things, all these excuses, are good things. They're actually gifts from God. They're wonderful things. The problem is that these people have made them more important than receiving the invitation to the feast. That made them more important than the God who made them. The one who loves them. The one who wants to invite them in to a relationship of generosity, of forgiveness, of love. These things become more important. There's something bigger than the feast. There's someone more important than Jesus. Or maybe it's fun and popularity. There's a knock at the door. The invite's thrust into your hand. But it's the faces of your friends that fill your mind. Now, I was going to say this applies to young people, but hey, that's surely naive, isn't it? Applies to us all, isn't it? What will my friends say if I put Jesus first instead of them? What would they say if you preferred to go and spend an evening doing stuff like this, learning God's word? What would your friends think if you wanted to spend an evening with a crowd of Christians instead of dancing to everybody else's agenda? You dare not. You dare not look the guy in the eye as you pass the invite back to him. Again, you're polite and you're pleasant, but it's a very clear what? No. Why? Well, there's something bigger than the feast, and there's someone more important than Jesus. You're just like the people in the story. You're unprepared. In the light of who gives the invitation and what he's inviting you to, the excuse is feeble. Your politeness is a smokescreen to the real issue. And Jesus would say that those responses are one sure way of proving that you are proud. You would rather say no to the King of Heaven and an invitation to his generosity and love and forgiveness. You'd rather say no to him. That, Jesus says, defines what a proud person is. If that's your position, as you look God in the eye and you say no, that is Jesus' definition of what it means to be proud. You think that you don't really need the invite. You think you can say no to God's lavish generosity without any consequences. Now, your question might be, how has God revealed his lavish generosity to me? The answer is the cross. It was there that God dealt with our selfishness and rebellion. It was there that Jesus chose to take the punishment for your rebellion. He took the punishment for what my sin deserved. Instead of me receiving it, he received it. And today in love, he commands you and me to accept his invitation to be forgiven. He doesn't ask you. He doesn't plead with you. I might plead with you. I love you. I long that you would follow Jesus. I long that you would enjoy his forgiveness. I long that you would get into heaven. I might plead. But I'm not God. Jesus commands. In love, he commands you today to accept his forgiveness. So what's your answer? Are you a religious person? Offended at being called a rebel against God? Offended that you can't earn heaven and have to accept it as a generous gift? Or will you today, this evening, humble yourself? Admit to being a rebel. Humble yourself. Humble yourself enough to accept an invitation from the God who loves you, from the God who wants you to come in, to enjoy him, to enjoy knowing him, to enjoy loving him, to enjoy an eternity with him. The party awaits. The servant is waiting in the car and he's bibbing the horn. What's your answer? Let's bow our heads, shall we? Father in heaven, we thank you that you are a God who is full of generosity. You're a God who loves us and invites us in. There's no one, whatever packaging we come in, good or bad, you long to invite us in. Invite us in to be forgiven. Invite us in to be loved. Invite us in to the party. Father, pray that each person here would be wise enough to accept the invitation, obey the command. In Jesus' precious name. Amen.